Wizards GM Will Dawkins will be on with us at 10:30. So 30 minutes from now, the general manager of the Wizards will join us. And then at 11, one of my favorite people to watch, and I thought she did a phenomenal job on the draft the last two nights, Monica McNutt from ESPN will join us. She's from here. She played at Georgetown. She'll join us at 11. Ben will join us a little bit later on in the show at 12. I'll get to, you know, what the Wizards did last night here in a moment. But this from Steele in Rockville. Steele writes, Kevin, the defense is fine. They are well coached. They've added size and playmaking. Please relax. If I hear about the defense again, I'm going to scream. You know, a lot of you are not overly concerned about the defense. And look, the truth is, like we say with a lot of these things, especially when it comes to things like the draft, and by the way, just NFL seasons in general, you really don't know until they start playing games. But, you know, are they well coached on defense? I mean, I certainly trust in the overall staff. I think they've got a very good staff. I think it's a borderline top 10 coaching staff. We talked about that last week. Certainly the combination, I think, of Quinn and the offensive coordinator, Kingsbury, is a really good 1-2 combination. You know, Joe Witt Jr.'s, I'm not knocking him, but let's face it, if we're going strictly on results, it was a bad defense last year. You know, it wasn't a good defensive football team. 26th against the run per DVOA, 23rd overall defensively, not a team that was a massive takeaway team. I mean, it was nice that they got the four they got in the playoff game at Detroit. That was huge. But I don't know that they are well coached defensively. I'm not saying they're not. I just don't know enough. I know what the results were last year. You know, and that certainly could have been as much about personnel as it was coaching. You know, the one thing that we talked about a lot during the course of the season last year is, for me anyway, I mean, I'm just speaking from my perspective, I thought there was a bit of a disconnect with some of the players they had on defense and the overall defensive performance. You know, I looked at them defensively and I thought, man, Frankie Louvu's really good. Bobby Wagner's really playing at a high level. Both of those players made All-Pro, second-team All-Pro. Mikey Sanristil's a really good player. I thought Quan Martin really came on towards the end of the season. I thought Jeremy Chinn played very well at times last year. You know, yes, up front, not so great. Certainly not a lot of consistency. Fowler Jr., outstanding as a pass rusher, but not good against the run. And there was kind of a disconnect for me during the course of the season. It was like, you know, they don't have terrible players, and yet they're not performing consistently enough. They're not good enough, and they're not making up for their inability to stop the run or their inconsistency against the pass. And, you know, we've said this a million times, you know, against some teams that weren't very good offensively. You know, they got a bit of a break, and they're not going to get that break this year. I mean, you can't say that definitively. But, you know, playing the Giants twice and playing the Cowboys twice without their starting quarterback and playing, you know, Cleveland with Deshaun Watson in the game and Carolina with, you know, subs abound and a rookie in Chicago and, you know, Jalen Hurts getting hurt in the second game. New Orleans' situation, that was a joke. You know, Michael Penix Jr. in his first road start, second overall start of his career. They just weren't very good. They just weren't. But they overcame it with great offense, clearly. But I don't think it's crazy at all. And it's not that I'm uptight about it. One of the things I've very much insisted on is there is a distinct possibility that this year will be completely different than last year, just based on the fact that that's the way it works in the NFL. There's tons of variance year to year with defense. Not as much offensive, you know, with offense, because you tend to have the same quarterback and that person touches the ball on every play, and there's just more consistency year to year with offenses, especially when you have the quarterback solved, whether it's an elite quarterback, whether it's a good quarterback, whether it's a middle of the road quarterback. Defensively, things just tend to change. Sometimes it's just the competition you face. Sometimes it's just maybe the Washington situation in 2025. It's the second year of the same staff. The first year was kind of a year to acclimate to a whole new scheme, a whole new system. Acclimate to each other. They had a lot of players that had never played with each other, you know, last year. And, you know, something that we pointed out, and Quinn pointed it out first, you know, at some point, you know, second half of the season, when he said about his run defense, he said, you know, we've played some really good running backs, and they did last year, and they're going to again this year. So I don't know. You're not going to hear me stop talking about this steal in Rockville, and that means you're going to scream more, but this is the biggest question mark, the biggest mystery, the biggest red flag, the biggest who the hell knows heading into the season. And it's not unfair, based on what they did in the offseason with personnel, to say that, you know, the flag is less red than it was before free agency and before the draft. We don't know that Kinlaw, Wise, Goldman, Jones, Harris, Amos are going to be massive difference makers. I'll tell you what, I look at the players coming back. I look at Frankie Louvu, who was a great player, I think arguably a top three player on the team last year. You know, this is a guy now in his prime, second year in the system. He has star potential. I mean, he was a All-Pro last year. You know, by definition, he's already a star player. I look at Louvu. I look at Daron Payne. We know what he's capable of. And he wasn't that last year, and he wasn't that the year before. If he gets back to what he was during that contract year in 2022, you've got, you know, you've got a top 10-ish defensive tackle. You do, if he plays consistently at the level that he's capable of playing at. And the thing that I mentioned the other day, I think it was with Logan Paulson, he's only 28 years old. I mean, this is not a guy that is in his early 30s. He's 28. This is the prime of his career. I look at a guy like Dorrance Armstrong, who really came on at the end of the year and came up big in the postseason, really big in the postseason. I also look at, you know, a guy like Johnny Newton, a talent, a playmaker in college, a havoc wreaker as the Big Ten Defensive Player of the Year. But remember, last year he was coming into the season off of those injuries, and, you know, there were moments, but there certainly wasn't, you know, a season that you could put together and say, man, this guy really showed me a lot. Maybe this is the year that Johnny Newton becomes a force. He was an absolute wrecking machine in college. Jordan McGee, they loved him, you know, last year. Was hurt, couldn't do much. And then Marshawn Lattimore is critical, because I'm not counting, personally I'm not, on Trey Amos to be ready as a rookie. Just simply based on the position historically. The position historically doesn't provide, you know, lights out play in year one. There are exceptions to the rule. We've seen him recently, you know, with Sauce Gardner and with Pat Surtain. And last year, to a certain degree, Mikey Sanders still. But more times than not, rookies, first rounders, second rounders, third rounders, they need reps, they need games, they need experience. So Lattimore is huge in terms of what this defense will be. And then, you know, these are the players that you really, if they're going to make a big jump from where they were last year to this year, if we're going to get that variance of wasn't good last year, but look at what happened this year. All of a sudden, they're a really good defense. If you're going to get that, the players that I mentioned, I think, are going to be critical to that. You know, it's possible guys we're not thinking about who have been mentioned, you know, John Baptiste, Hampton, you know, could end up being, you know, significant contributors, Percy Butler, and we're not thinking, you know, a lot about them. But the guys I mentioned, you know, Luvu, by the way, also Wagner not falling off a cliff age-wise. Now, maybe they think Jordan McGee is a really good player. And if Bobby Wagner isn't at 35 years old, isn't what he was last year and the year before, because he's had two back-to-back excellent years here. I mean, he is a Hall of Famer. But maybe they love the idea of what Jordan McGee can do or what a guy like Dominique Hampton can do. But, yeah, the guys that I mentioned, they got to have step-up situations. I think I'm most confident in Luvu. More than any other player on defense, I'm most confident in number four. Like, that's a dude. That's a guy that really can play. And I would not be surprised if they scheme him up more as a pass rusher than they even did last year. You know, I think he could be a doubt. Does he put his hand in the dirt on third down? I don't know. But, you know, the Micah Parsons treatment, you know, with Quinn and Witt Jr. when they were in Dallas, moving him around, which they did with Luvu last year. You know, maybe those eight sacks become 12 or 13 in 2025. You know, maybe a guy like Dorrance Armstrong, who finished, you know, incredibly, 3.5 sacks in the three postseason games, you know, along with a forced fumble, a huge forced fumble. Maybe he ends up becoming, you know, the beneficiary of more size, Deron Payne's stepped up play, and Frankie Luvu maybe becoming a guy that defenses have to game plan for. But yeah, Steel in Rockville, I'm not going to stop talking about it. I mean, this is, you know, especially when we get to training camp and we start hearing from coaches and players and we start seeing what it looks like in terms of who's going to start and what the rotation may look like. And you don't learn a lot from the games, but you learn a lot sometimes from what they say and even from those joint practices that they will hold. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm not scared of it. I'm not like, it's going to suck. I'm like, it's got to step up in a big way. And it's going to be interesting to see if they figured it out with their acquisitions or they figured it out in year two with this, you know, same core group. And we'll see. Because with the schedule they have, and I, you know me, most of you do, I'm not a big schedule guy, but the way it looks now, and it doesn't mean it's going to look that way when you get there, it's going to have to be better than it was last year. Or the offense isn't going to get as many opportunities. The offense is going to have to even be better than they were last year to get back to that, you know, 12 win total where you're contending perhaps for a division title and home field. Because that's really how you get to the Super Bowl, more times than not. Now, Washington won two road playoff games last year. They did. But the, you know, the teams that played at home throughout ended up in the Super Bowl. And that usually happens more often than not. And so, ultimately, to get to the Super Bowl and have a chance to win the Super Bowl, and you got to get there first, you really have to win the division. You got to beat out Philadelphia heading into this season. And therefore, you know, you could be potentially a 1 or a 2 seed, hopefully. Could be a 3 or a 4, but hopefully a top 2 seed where you're guaranteed at least 2 home playoff games. But thanks, Steele, for reaching out. It is definitely a topic for sure, even though you don't think it is. And, you know, the coaching standpoint, I'm not critical of their coaching. I just, you know, if we're just looking at results, and it's not like, you know, they had to be on the field last year in adverse situations because their offense wasn't doing enough. They were in advantageous situations throughout the season. Don't forget that. A lot of times you can look at a defense at the end of the year and say, well, they were on the field too much. They got worn down. their offense couldn't, you know, keep the score in a context that was competitive. No, they had an offense that was top five in the league that basically didn't punt in a lot of games. So there's that too. So you got, you know, sort of a bottom third of the league performance defensively with an unbelievable offense that gave them every opportunity to be rested and to, you know, to be good. You know, it's not like the offense was turning the ball over deep in their territory game in and game out, or going three and out over and over and punting from their own 10, and teams were starting with great field position. That's not what it was. We know that. I mean, there were games in which the offense literally, there was no chance that the defense was going to get them off the field. So we'll see. The results weren't good enough, period. They've got to be better in 2025. You know, it reminds me that, you know, the NFL is so, you know, year to year, month to month, week to week. It's really week to week. When you have a great quarterback, sometimes you get into, no, it's more year to year. And I think they have a great quarterback. I know that some of you have reached out to say, man, you are really, really sure of Jaden Daniels and Cliff Kingsbury in this offense. Yeah, I haven't given much thought at all to them not being good on offense in 2025. The only way that happens is injuries. If the offense ends up being not very good in 2025, for me, looking at what, witnessing what I saw last year, there's only one way that they take a major step back, and it's health, it's injuries. Because if they trot, you know, 5-17 and a better offensive line and a healthy and playing with urgency Deebo Samuel out on the field, I just don't see how this team isn't dynamic again offensively and isn't really effective offensively. It'd be hard to be as good as they were last year, but I wouldn't put it past them. I think they have the ability to be as good, if not better. They certainly got better up front. You know, everything they did in the offseason, there's only one, you know, absolute in terms of where they improved, and that is along the offensive line. They added one of the top three pass-protecting left tackles in the game, one of the top 5-6 tackles overall in the game. So that's where they got better. And look, they may have overperformed at times last year. I think they did. But defense heading into 2025. We might talk about it again between now and the season opener on September 7th against the Giants. Will Dawkins, the Wizards GM, will join us at 10:30. When we come back, we'll update what the Wizards did last night and tell you about the Ace Bailey saga, which is getting strange. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app.
With the 43rd pick in the 2025 NBA Draft, the Washington Wizards select Jahmyr Watkins from Florida State University.
So that was the second rounder they picked up in the trade with Utah in the first round on Wednesday night when they traded from 18 back to 21. Remember, their second round picker, number 40 overall, which I forget whose that was to begin with, they had traded to New Orleans as part of the Jordan Poole CJ McCollum deal. But they picked Jahmyr Watkins, Florida State. Look, just, it's really easy on this guy. Another, you know, 6'5 wing player, but this guy is all about his, you know, long arms, his wingspan, and his defensive ability. How much did I watch Jahmyr Watkins? None until last night. But what you saw when you watched is you saw great anticipation, great on-ball defender, the long arm really created a problem for weaker ball handlers. I mean, the number of just pure picks he had, you know, as a guy turned, reaching, knocking the ball out, and then going and getting it was really impressive. Very, very good competitor. Man, that seems to be a theme among the players they take. They want guys that are higher motor and very competitive. And apparently nobody helped himself as much in the combine as Jameer Watkins did. They said high level intensity, high motor defensively, steals all over the court. He's an older player. He's not 18 or 19. He's going to turn 24 next month, but he is physically filled out, you know, from a maturity standpoint, and he can definitely get after it defensively. So that's what they got. Actually, to me, you know, he didn't shoot it well, and the scouting report is that he doesn't shoot it well. I don't think the stroke looked that bad, to be honest with you, and he could really finish around the rim. So there was that too. So Jameer Watkins to go with Will Riley and Trey Johnson from night number one. Will Dawkins, the general manager, is going to join us here in roughly 3 minutes. So I don't know if you're following this story about Ace Bailey. Well, Ace Bailey was selected number 5 overall by the Utah Jazz. Apparently, they had no clue the Utah Jazz were even interested. And the reporting is that Ace Bailey's representatives informed a team in the top 5 that they did not want that team to select Ace Bailey. Honestly, who the hell is Ace Bailey to be dictating which teams can and can't take him? I mean, this is not Wembanyama. This isn't Zion. This isn't LeBron. All due respect. Look, many of you know that I was not the Ace Bailey guy. I recognize the talent. I do. But I just think that there were a few red flags around him, including the game he had in College Park against Maryland, which I referenced many times. But now, additional reporting this morning, I guess he was supposed to report to Salt Lake City with Walter Clayton Jr., their other first-round pick, for sort of the press conference. Summer League starts next week, and he has not reported. Now, Brian Windhorst, ESPN, said there's not a crisis yet, with the Jazz are saying he's not expected in Utah until the weekend. He wasn't on the flight with Walter Clayton Jr., but he's not expected until the weekend. Needs to be there by Monday when training camp for Summer League begins. We'll see. We'll see if that works out for the Utah Jazz. All right, joining us right now, the Wizards have had a busy week, and this man's had a very busy week. The trade on Tuesday with New Orleans, 2 first-round picks on Wednesday night, and then they added another pick last night. Joining me right now, and it's a pleasure, Wizards General Manager Will Dawkins. Will, thanks. I appreciate you giving me some time this morning. All the months of preparation, if not years, really. And, you know, the 2 nights just fly by. It's over in like 28 hours. You've been through a ton of these during your career. I'm sure some of them go kind of how you plan them to go. Others end up being surprises after surprises. How would you describe this one?
Yeah, first off, thanks for having me. Happy to be on this morning. I would say very rarely do they go as you plan. I think a lot of times you just put in the work and preparation and try to build through every contingency you can think through. And we try to do that for as long as possible. But I'd say last 2 days were fun for our group. We got better and we're able to get guys that we were targeting. So we felt good about the outcome for sure.
So rarely it goes the way it's supposed to. In the first round, you're sitting there at 6. Did it go the way you thought it would go? And did you get the guy you wanted?
Yeah, Trey's someone that we were excited about, who was in our top 5 all year. Won't tell you where he was, but he was up there. And when you get that guy, when you fall out of the top 5 on lottery night, you still feel pretty good about that. So our scouts were on him early, and we went to see him practice, play a lot early, and he just was able to continue that run in SEC play. The scoring prowess that he had was really impressive for a freshman.
So what did you love most about him?
Once we got to know him, during the visit, I really fell in love with his passion for the game, his IQ, and his ability to see the game and be ahead of plays. We threw him in a couple film sessions, put him in the workout and threw him in Wizards play calls, and he picked up on stuff really quickly. But at the end of the day, he's a pure hooper. He's someone that has a repeatable shot. It's rare when you find someone who can shoot the ball with the same efficiency off the dribble as he does off the catch at such a high clip. So he's someone that's going to score. He's got to get better scoring at the rim, but he can score from deep. He can score from the mid-range, and he's got a passing creativity that will be, I think, exposed a little bit and enlightened a little bit more when he's with us.
Is it true, in your opinion, that once a shooter, always a shooter? Like, somebody who's a shooter at 10 can still shoot it at 60?
Yeah, I think shooting is a swing skill that's hard to develop at times. You really have to work on it, but when you master it early and you have that size to where he has the wingspan to still get it off over people, that's not going to change.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in the specific things you look for in a shooter, other than he just makes a lot of them. Tell me about, like, what you look for in a stroke, in a setup, in, you know, how that kind of matches Trey's shooting ability.
Yeah, I think shooting is one of those skills where repetition is probably the most important thing. I think I've grown as an evaluator in terms of actual release of shots and technique, but there are some things that remain pure. And when you watch him versus some of the elite shooters, the fact that the ball gets the type of rotation it does, comes off his final two fingers very easily. He has the rotation, but it's also a repeatable shot, whether he shoots it quickly or has a full time to gather. And he has the range where his body mechanics are exactly the same no matter where he is. And to me, someone that has that type of balance to shoot it off 1 foot, 2 feet, wherever he catches it from, like that, that's a difficult shot to contest. And for us, I think it's a repeatable shot for him, which makes him the type of high arcing player that he is.
Yeah, you really see that backward rotation off those fingers. But I'm wondering about the release. Do you think it's quick enough?
I do. And I think he was someone in the SEC that had two players draped on him the entire last part of the season. And he wasn't getting a lot of open shots. So for him to be able to create off the dribble and get those shots, which are a little bit more tough and contested, playing with the guys that we have now, which hopefully we'll get some easier ones and he won't need to shoot it as quick. But we put him in drills where you had to catch it, not be able to bring it down and try to keep that same elbow and release. And he's able to do it now without spending a lot of time on it.
I heard your answer the other night to Trey admitting and appreciating, by the way, that you guys showed him, you know, some of the moments that weren't so flattering for him. And even though you said you weren't thrilled, I thought maybe some of it was tongue-in-cheek. Maybe it wasn't. But I loved your answer when you said that you do it because you want to see how he handles answering it. So what are you looking for in how a player handles seeing some of their rough moments?
Yeah, I think it's a big thing to just see how they communicate. They're going to be put in situations where they're going to have to talk and speak in front of the coaches and their players. I think it shows a sign of humility for a player to admit kind of what's going on, but it also gives us a lot of answers to the test. The reasons why you go to practice and you go to shoot around is to try to understand game plans and schemes and what's really being asked of them. And when players can repeat back and remember the situations and know what the coverages were, it shows you that they're at least watching and trying to get better. So we're looking for people that want to improve, won't run, and be authentic. And we're going to hit you between the eyes while you're here. We want to make sure you can handle that. And I think it's always good for us to get on the front end of that and know the type of person we're coming in, and they know the environment they're walking into. And we're always going to try to get 1% better every single day. And I think while he was here, he did that. And I think that's why he mentioned it, because when you come in, we don't just want to roll the balls out. We want to see where you're at, and hopefully you learn something.
Yeah, you know, over the years, I've talked to so many GMs and coaches who, you know, have said they do the same thing with young players that come in for the interviews, and they're looking to see, you know, when they throw an interception, you know, what happened on this play. And what they're looking for is accountability, but most importantly, did he learn from it? Or is he throwing people under the bus and making excuses? That's a big reveal on character. True?
Very true. The accountability piece, you do get in those film sessions, and it was the coach this, it was my teammate was supposed to be here. So you have to ask those type of questions. But we also try to do a good job of cutting it up so that we're showing the same exact situation and then making the right read as well. So like, okay, tell me the difference between this and this. What part of the season was this? When did you grow and figure this read out? Like that way we can go behind the process of it. But you're absolutely right. There are some excuse makers out there and you don't want too many of them in your building. So that's also a tell for us.
One of the things that I noticed in watching Trey in some of those, you know, incredible SEC games this year is just how fearless he was. Like, first game in Vegas against Ohio State, he put up 20 shots. He had 10 three-point attempts and ended up with 29. You've mentioned, you know, the competitive high motors of Riley and of Trey Johnson, and I think the guy you drafted last night as well. With scorers and shooters in particular, when a guy walks out onto the court and thinks he's open, the first time he touches the ball wherever he is there a balance of that being really good and also not being great?
Yeah, I think those guys that we drafted with Will Riley and Jameer, they're all at different phases of career where they're finding themselves still. But they are confident. And when you talk about Trey and some of his performances out the gate, we'd rather have to turn you down than turn you up. And that's kind of what we look for in our players. So we want them to be aggressive, be confident, and go get it from the tip. And we think we added three guys that are going to do that.
Coach Thompson, John Thompson, the junior, as in the legendary Coach Thompson, worked for this station for many years, and he always said, I'd rather have to tame, you know, an animal than resurrect a corpse. And I think that's exactly you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, he said it a little bit more eloquently than me.
No, you said it well, too. So tell us about what you guys liked in Will Riley.
Yeah, so Will's someone who has traditional size for his position. He's someone who, when you watched him prior to coming to Illinois, was someone who had the ball in his hands, could create plays, make shots, and actually get to the rim. And I think we saw that once they had some injuries at Illinois, the second part of the year, they started to put the ball in his hands and give him an opportunity to just create. And he was fearless on the offensive end, went toe-to-toe in another really physical conference. And he's someone who, when we checked in on his body, we expect him to even grow some more. So for him to be able to be 70th percentile in assist and 85th percentile in assist to turnover ratio, it means he protects the ball and looks for others while being able to score. And that's what we're looking for, guys that can just rebound it and bring the ball up. When you have Alex and Keyshawn and Bub, Bilal, and all the guys we have, we just want to play offensive basketball where you don't know who's starting it and everybody can be a threat.
You know, Will, in watching Oklahoma City over the last 2 months, and you were a big part of, you know, the architect of that team, and watching the players that you look for now, man, high motor, intense, highly competitive personalities are a priority for you guys, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a lot of characteristics we look for in the 94 by 50. We're pretty specific on what we look for on the court. But we also have an environmental bucket that we look for, and we send our scouts out there to get as much intel and information as we can to make sure that when we bring these guys into the building, we want push guys, meaning that we want guys that come in that have similar attributes and are going to just only push the group forward. You don't want too many pull guys that need to be pulled around and eventually try to catch up. So right now we're in the mode of giving everyone that comes in is going to have that competitive fiber and that juice and that work ethic and be serious craftsmen, because that's the environment we're trying to build, so that they push everybody in the gym. So having multiple players that want to compete and get after it, but will do so the right way and be good teammates, those guys are going to do well here in D.C.
You know, Brad Underwood said about Will Riley when you guys picked him the other night, his coach at Illinois said he's the second best offensive player he's ever coached, next to Michael Beasley when he was an assistant with Frank Martin way back in the day. He's got that kind of potential offensively?
I did not see that comment. I got to know him well when he was at Oklahoma State and I was at Oklahoma. And I remember those Beasley days at Kansas State. Those were some fun practices to go watch as a young evaluator.
I bet.
But I would say if he were to go back in the Big Ten, we expected him to have a massive jump, and you wouldn't be getting a player as offensively gifted as him in the 20s. Plus, we were able to move back and still get him and pick up three assets in the second round. So Mike Winger, Mike Hartman, those guys that are helping with our strategy piece. It was a good combination of evaluation and a strategy coming together that first night of the draft. And we knew that we were getting a player who wouldn't be in that range if he would have went back to school. So we bet on that type of development.
All right. Tell me what you got last night in the Florida State kid. Is he Lou Dort?
He is physical. He is long. He is tough. He is defensive-minded. And that's what we really liked about him. But he also is someone that moved the scoreboard and got better offensively. But each meeting with these kids are different, you know. Got to spend a lot of time at dinner with Trey. Actually got a one-on-one breakfast with Will, like, before the workout. And then you get Jameer in your office, and he's just like, I'm all business. I'm here to hoop. Put me on whoever you want. I'm going to compete. And you just felt that vibe, and then he went out there and did it. And you're like, you are who we thought you were, and that's why we targeted him. But he just plays with a force and a physicality on both ends, and that's kind of a rare combination when you can be tops in the country in free throw attempts, but also 75th percentile in steals. So, like, you're hitting people on both ends, and that's what we need.
Is Dort a good comp or not? I mean, the build isn't the same, but is that a good comp?
Not too far off. I think when Lou went undrafted, he kind of had a little bit more of an offensive vibe to him and kind of transformed and realized that's how you get on the floor and has continued to improve offensively, defensively, and obviously a first-team all-defensive guy from the work he put in. So, again, this is the type of kid you bet on physically to be able to put him in those type of situations.
Do you guys do that? We do that.
Do like all the other guys. Say it again, I'm sorry?
No, do you guys do that? We do that all the time. You know, who's his comp? You know, who's his NBA comp? Do you do that as you evaluate players?
Yeah, as long as we're not being lazy with it. As you can imagine in those scouting meetings, I don't want the lazy comps. I want us to think through them, try to find physical comps as well as basketball comps. And sometimes you have to blend the comparisons of the two and let those guys have an opportunity. But it's more of a range. Like, on a high end, he can have this type of impact on a team. And that's the most important thing that we look for.
So what's Trey Johnson's high end comp? Who?
I think he's someone who is going to make plays for others and be able to stay on the floor in the playoffs and impact it on both ends. And that's a high level player for us.
But do you have a name? Do you have a comp?
No, I think you can ask him because he kind of favors his game after a few people. But the guys that are making deep playoff runs that could play on the ball and are always a threat, he kind of fits in the mold of those guys.
We're talking to Will Dawkins, the Wizards general manager. Let me just make sure. Can you talk about the trade at this point from earlier this week or not?
Not officially. That has not gone through yet.
All right. Then let's just talk about the roster as it stands now, and maybe there are changes coming. We haven't had free agency yet. But size on the roster next year, do you have enough of it, or is more coming?
Yeah, I would say when you look at some of the transactions that haven't gone through yet, when you're having to make those challenging and difficult decisions during the rebuild phase, the main focus is always going to be to put the organization in a position for our long-term success. And for us, the decisions we made and will continue to make are less about position and more about getting the type of guys we want in here stylistically, and then also giving them the runway to develop, but providing us strategically the most flexibility to continue to add. So as we go through this process of free agency and finalizing the roster and making moves and trades potentially, I think we have a good assortment of young players that want to play and veteran players who are more than capable of playing and are actually very beneficial and helpful to have around because they're good players on the court as well. So we have a good blend of who we want in the locker room right now. We'll definitely make a few more tweaks, but I wouldn't say we're after one specific thing heading into free agency.
Well, I think you did, if everybody was paying attention, you kind of answered the question. I think one of the parts that I just want to nail down, because I think you implied it there, is this is the year where it's time to kind of turn the team over to these very young players that you've picked the last couple of years and give them higher usage rates, more shot attempts, more minutes, etc., right?
Yeah, I think Brian did a tremendous job. Brian Keefe, our head coach, last year. Three of those rookies that we drafted were top five in minutes for their rookie class. So he gave them experience, and that's when they were able to produce at a high level. We have a lot of confidence in them, but also Bilal, Champagne, AJ, some of our other young players and the players we've drafted, Tristan, to kind of give those guys an opportunity as well. And at the end of the day, staying flexible and playing deep rotations, I think, is what proved was beneficial for a lot of these teams in the playoffs. So establishing that at an early age, I think, is good as well.
All right, last one, and I appreciate the time. So how excited were you, and how much pride did you take in watching your former team, Oklahoma City, win it all?
Super happy, overjoyed for them, everyone in the city, but everyone I work with and all the teammates that all the players that have come through in the Thunder organization. Definitely excited for all that. They have some great people over there. They deserved it. My family was super excited. My family that lived back in Oklahoma were at the games and at the parade. So happy for them. Hopefully they can keep it going down there, but we're kind of focused on building our own path here in D.C. But it was a cool moment for sure.
Congrats on the last few days. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
No, anytime. You guys have a good one.
Yep. Will Dawkins, everybody, Wizards general manager. We'll talk about some of the things he said. And then Monica McNutt from ESPN will join us at 11 a.m. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. You can also watch the show now on the Team 980's YouTube page. Subscribe and like it when you get there. Will Dawkins was good. He's always good when we get the occasional opportunity to have him on the show. I liked both picks. Last night, you know, I don't know a ton about the player they selected in Jameer Watkins from Florida State, but when you watch the highlights, and highlights don't always tell the story, but, I mean, he's a relentless competitor and defender, and super long arms and really kind of good feel defensively. Lu Dort is a comp in the way he defends, not in physical build, even though they're basically the same height and same weight. Lu Dort's built like a linebacker, like a middle linebacker, and is one hell of a defender. Did you see this from the NFL yesterday? Justin Tucker, former Ravens kicker, remember they released him, has been suspended for the first 10 weeks of the upcoming 2025 regular season after the NFL, you know, found that he violated the personal conduct policy. Tucker, if you don't know, and if you haven't followed it, sort of a Deshaun Watson situation, was accused of sexual misconduct by 16 massage therapists from 8 high-end spas and wellness centers in the Baltimore area. All of the alleged misconduct reportedly occurred between 2012 and 2016. That was during his first 5 seasons in the NFL. The Ravens just decided on May 5th to move on without him. Now, Deshaun Watson ended up getting traded for and getting the biggest, you know, guaranteed contract, or the most guaranteed dollars in a contract in NFL history, which, by the way, led to that collusion situation in which, you know, that was arbitrated recently. We talked about that earlier in the week. You know, when you play quarterback and you're talented, and Deshaun Watson is talented and played at a very high level early in his career, I think teams are probably more willing, especially if you don't have one, to just go for it, which Cleveland did. Now, in that moment, Washington could have never gone for it because of the nature of the disgusting franchise that they already were. There was just no way to survive that. I mean, they were already in the moment losing customers, fans, hand over fist. And if they had done that with, you know, all that was being investigated relative to the way they treated women in their organization, that would have been a death knell almost. In some ways, and others would have said, we got Deshaun Watson, let's go. But I think with a kicker, And by the way, let's not forget, Justin Tucker is now, he's 30, I think he's like 35, 36 years old. Now, kickers age well, obviously. I don't know that he's ever going to play in the NFL again. I guess late in the season, if a team that is contending loses its kicker or has a kicker problem and the suspension is over. By the way, does this suspension only happen if he's on a roster? Does it kick in if he's not on a roster, or does it start to kick in once he gets signed? I actually think it's the latter, right? Wait, hold on. Here it is. In the ESPN story, Tucker can serve the suspension as a free agent and is free to sign with an NFL team. If he were to sign with a team, he could attend training camp and play in preseason games before the suspension starts. Okay, yes, yeah, so he can serve the suspension as a free agent. So at the end of the year, after 10 weeks, he's eligible to kick for somebody. Think late season, contending team, kicker gets injured or kicker's missed a bunch and has been a bad kicker all year. Yeah, I guess somebody might do it, right? Somebody might do it. But kickers aren't quarterbacks. There are plenty of kickers to be had. By the way, let's also talk about the fact that Justin Tucker had a terrible season last year, his worst of his career. You know, he was 22 of 30 on field goals. And didn't he miss like almost every kick beyond 50 or something like that? He was 73.3% on field goals, which was the lowest percentage of his career by far. No, he was 6 of 11 from beyond 50, but he missed 5 field goals from beyond 50. All right, Monica McNutt from ESPN will join us next.